Hey everyone, so excited that you'll be joining me for this episode of Introspectional. This is kind of like Strike Talk Part 2, so I'm really excited to share this episode with you. In this episode, I'll be talking to writer Ricky Manning and writer Brittany Northcross. Now, one of the challenges about talking about media is how to talk about it without, you know, essentially crossing the virtual picket line. So not doing promotion and all that type of stuff. So that has been this like challenge with this particular episode, since we are talking about the work and the work has titles, etc., etc. So in order to kind of protect myself as much as possible, I actually did reach out to SAG, reach out to the Screen Actors Guild and told them about this episode and, hey, what do I need to do? Here's what they said. I am going to read this email out to you word for word. It says, Leticia, thanks for reaching out. It's fine to mention movies or TV shows in passing as part of a broader conversation. For instance, if a guest is talking about why AI projections are so important, they might mention an episode of Black Mirror that explores the terrifying course AI could take. By contrast, a lengthy discussion of Black Mirror or series or film will be considered promotional and not allowed. It is also okay to mention your or your guest's body of work in general in your discussion. It is not okay to focus questions or answers on any particular project or projects. Obviously, the line between mentioning and discussing is blurry, and only you and your guests know the length with which a struck work is discussed. Would it be possible to edit or bleep out show titles? We understand that might be too difficult, but any effort to prevent promotion of struck work is wonderful and an expression of solidarity. Hope this helps. So, with all of that in mind, here is what I'm planning to do with this episode. Especially since we are talking about the strike and we're talking about people's general body of work. So, if we're talking about the general body of work, I am typically keeping the titles in. Because they said, again, it's okay to mention your guest's body of work in general of your discussion. Quote from the email. However, there are larger, lengthier discussions of particularly works that I love, in this episode. That I have, like, essentially ignored in the editing, so you will not hear them. So this is like the strike version of this episode. After the strikes are over, I will re-release this episode with fuller discussions of some of the things that you missed, because it's so good. So, like I said, so you are going to hear the names of certain properties. They will be in passing, or part of a larger conversation about craft. However, we will not go into really in-depth questions. So there'll be kind of larger discussions about the collaborative nature of writing and the collaborative nature of production and all of that, and kind of what does that mean overall. But less, this show was really great, this episode was really awesome, etc., etc. Again, the line is super, super, super blurry. I'm trying my best. Yeah. please enjoy this episode, and I look forward to talking to you later. Bye.
Hi, everybody, and welcome back to Introspectional. I am so excited for you to join me again, and I am delighted to have my two guests here who are incredible writers, and we shall learn a lot today. So, first of all, Ricky, can you introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about some of the shows that you have worked on?
Hi, I'm Ricky Manning, or as I call myself sometimes, Frunium Ricky Manning. You can ask me later on what Frunium is all about, and maybe I'll tell you, maybe I won't, probably will, because it's not that interesting and it'll take some time. I've done a whole bunch of mostly hour television, mostly sci-fi genre, but not always. My first staff job was on a show called Fame with Debbie Allen and a musical at MGM. I've also done most prominently Star Trek The Next Generation for on and off the first three seasons. All four seasons, all 88 episodes of Farscape. So I did, what, two freelance scripts for Sliders. I created and ran a show called Beyond Reality, which was a little Canadian half-hour drama, which unfortunately you can't find anywhere, but it was basically X-Files before X-Files, a little half-hour drama paranormal show. I did 18 episodes of Tech War with William Shatner and Greg Evigan, and yeah, a whole bunch of other stuff which doesn't spring to mind. I also have lately been doing a whole bunch of teaching at UCLA Extension, teaching TV drama writing, both on campus and on the Zoom. Most recently also, I've taught for a couple of summers in Cologne, Germany at the International Film School Cologne to an international group of students who are curious about how we Americans, how we Yanks do the writer's room and how we collaborate in the writer's room.
Thank you so much. I'm so excited to have you here as a huge sci-fi fan myself. As you may not know, my podcast is called Introspectional, which stands for having interesting conversations about speculative media, which is what you do. Oh, yeah, that's awesome.
I try my best to make it interesting.
And I have another wonderful writer with us, Brittany Northcross. Brittany, can you introduce yourself and tell us a little about some of the things that you've been doing?
Hello. Hi, my name is Brittany Northcross. I'm originally from Tennessee. I grew up between Memphis and Nashville. Gosh, I don't have as interesting of a biography as Ricky, but I'm going to try.
He lies, but that's okay, though.
No, I'm going to say where I am in life, that I was one of those people who told their parents that they were going to be a lawyer because I chose to study history in college. And I think I realized too late that really I liked the story part of history. And so I had a really roundabout route of not going to law school to eventually going to film school and before coming out to LA, where I've had the privilege to work on some shows like Tom Swift, which was a sci-fi show on the CW, Party of Five, and then some of my own projects that I've been able to sell to networks.
Excellent.
Which I think is super cool. First of all, selling your own projects, working on all these shows, and it's very hard to, I think, describe and for a lot of people understand, like, how do people get started in writing for television or writing for the screen? It's a very kind of almost nebulous process. I think we know now, you have more informed viewers, that they know that there are writers, that there is a process, but it's still like, how does this thing happen? And no one knows. So one of my first questions to both of you is, how did you get started? How did you go from being a lawyer to being on staff?
Okay. But it was also almost lawyer.
Almost, like, lawyer. I'm saying almost lawyer.
Applied, took the LSAT, did never go, much to the disappointment still of my parents. But I'd say after graduating from film school, which, by the way, for anyone listening, no one in LA actually cares about if you go to film school. But if you choose that route, which I did, it's not because you have to have that education to be a filmmaker or work in television, but you really just want the education for yourself. And I think I came to filmmaking realizing that I wanted to be in this arena. I came to it very late. Some people know that they want to do this from when they're kids or when they're teenagers. I was post-college before I realized I really wanted to be here. And I knew that going to film school would give me that education that other people had been collecting over just their years getting experience. I thought I was going to stay in New York as an independent film producer and writer, but I knew that if you wanted to be on any part of the development process in this business, that you had to spend some time in LA. And this was about 2017. So I was just encouraged. I was at Columbia Film School. So a big cohort of us decided to move to Los Angeles together. And we were going to take on the industry because it's like, you just really have to have your friends around you and people who support you. And I did the agency thing where I got an internship first. And then I parlayed that into an assistant job at WME. And then
for the people who don't know, what is WME? Oh,
sorry, WME is William Morris Endeavor. It is one of the largest agencies in Hollywood. It's one of the big three, along with CAA and UTA. And I was there right when they were building what would become Endeavor Content, which is funny. It's funny because it's actually really what precipitated the big writer agency showdown in 2020, and Endeavor Content really no longer exists in its current form. But I was there as an assistant working in that department. I did that for almost 2 years. And even though I know what the WJ has to say about Endeavor content, personally, my bosses wanting to know that I wanted to be a writer, they were very supportive of me. And they said, look, you can continue working here and you can do the development work, or it's time for you to spread your wings and become a writer. And so they got me a job for a WME client. Her name was Amy Littman. She was about to start show running a new series, or a reboot of a series she had done called Party of Five. It's a reboot that they were putting on Freeform, and she needed an assistant. And so I think like within the span of 4 days, I just hopped jobs. And then I was a showrunner's assistant on the reboot for that show and totally got baptized in the art and craft of producing a season of television. Going into 2020, we were expecting to get a second season, but that's where I was hoping to make the jump to writing full time. And I would go to from being an assistant to hopefully writing on staff. But I guess like anybody else, 2020 didn't go according to anyone's plan. And right at the beginning of the pandemic, we found out they weren't bringing us back and we weren't getting the season two. So like everyone in this industry, I had to pivot. And I used the time at home to finish my own scripts so that I could hopefully get agents and managers and kind of representation and start working for myself. And as luck would have it, I did fairly quickly. It was really quite unusual that one of the first general meetings I did that summer of 2020, and general meetings, sorry, are where your reps set you up at every production company, studio, network, anyone they can think of to get you out there. And during 2020, the only thing we could do were Zoom meetings. So it was like constantly just Zooming, meeting people, saying what I was interested in, what I wanted to write on. I was just hoping for some staffing job. But one of those actually led to my first development sale. I co-wrote a medical drama with Sally Patrick that was in contention for the 2021 pilot development season at CBS. And it was only after that process that I got staffed. So I had a sale first and then I staffed, which generally it's like you staff, you get some experience, and then you can start the sale. 2020 made everything topsy-turvy and I just went for it. And yeah, that's how I got started.
That's really incredible. So I want to get the timeline from when you graduated film school to when you were staffed. How many years was that?
Okay. May 2017, graduated film school. Officially getting staffed summer 2021.
So
4 years, yeah.
4 years. So yeah. 4 years, which honestly, and you do not see Ricky clapping, but in the world of how you get staffed and coming out to LA and doing your thing, that's pretty quick.
Thank you.
That's from no one knowing your name to someone signing you and getting your WGA card. Like, that's pretty quick.
I guess it's just important to take your wins. But I guess when you're in it, you're just thinking about the next thing that you have to do. So I appreciate that. It certainly didn't feel quick. But I know other people, like much more talented writers that I graduated with, who I came out with, who are still trying to get their shot. So I am very grateful for that and hope that once everything is over, that they get to like make the inroads that I have.
And what was your journey like, Ricky? Because we're talking, what, early 80s?
Well, depending on where you want to start, earlier than that. I didn't want to be a lawyer. I know an awful lot of lawyers turn writers, as a matter of fact. It's curious. It seems to be a not an uncommon path, which I'm not sure if writing is just something that appeals to people that enjoy or thinking about law, or if law is so terrible that they just wind up doing other things and a lot of them come into screenwriting. I know an awful lot of lawyers turn writers.
And there's also a theater or drama school graduate to lawyer path. It's...
Oh, is there?
It's very the
grass is always greener. And most notably, a very talented writer named Belinda Snodgrass, who wrote the Measure of a Man episode for Next Generation, which is it's a legal episode. And she brought her law experience to bear there. But yeah, my story is I never wanted to be anything really else than a filmmaker. I think it was about three when my father was a school principal, elementary school principal, and he would on the weekend bring home some audiovisual equipment from the school. So like a slide projector or a film strip projector or a tape recorder. So I was exposed to all this magic stuff really early and just absolutely loved it. I can still remember the first time he brought home a movie projector in a 16 millimeter film, which he showed me at the house. And I took the reel of film and was looking at I just started unrolling the thing. And which is still a habit I have. If you leave a reel of film around me, I'll start taking it apart and looking at it. So I'm looking at this thing going, I was looking at the main title, I'm going like, all these pictures are the same, which doesn't seem to make any sense. That's redundant. Why do they have the same picture so many times? And my father, bless him, explained to me how the thing worked in 24 frames a second and persistence of vision and all that stuff. And I just remember something in my head just went click. And I was like, this is what I'm going to do. I want to make films. I'm going to be a filmmaker. Mm-hmm. So I did the whole, if you saw, Spielberg has done about 19 movies about Super 8 and so forth, about the kid making movies with the camera. That's me. I was definitely one of those. I had a Super 8 camera. I made a little superhero movie when I was in junior high school. First chance I got, I came out and I went to USC Cinema Film School here in Los Angeles. I never actually wanted to be a writer, though. I wanted to be an animator. I wanted to be a director. I wanted to be a filmmaker. I liked all the aspects of the craft. I just wanted to be a filmmaker. I'll make films, but writing, that's hard. I'll just take books and adapt them, because that'll be really easy, which is not correct at all. It's totally wrong, but what did I know? But that's it. As part of the major, I had to take some writing courses, and I had professors that somehow or other saw something in my terrible college stuff. And I got the best note that I've ever gotten in my life from one of my professors, which was, I hope you pursue writing because I think you could have a career in it. Mm-hmm. And that to me just, I'm just, what? I'd never thought in those terms, a career in writing, for crying out loud. And yeah, hey, the guy was right, because I actually have had a career in writing. I got a bachelor's and a master of fine arts in cinema production, which, as Brittany points out, means absolutely nothing. It opens no doors at all. Thankfully I was a TA, so I got, I didn't actually accumulate a lot of it. I got the breaks on some of that, but still, yeah. And so armed with this, with these dual degrees in cinema production from the prestigious USC Film School, and I had a writing partner that I'd met in film school, and we'd go out and drink, and we came up with an idea for a script that neither one of us wanted to turn loose of, so we became writing partners as a result. So armed with our degrees, we sprung out, and we were fairly lucky. We got our first writing job 8 years after graduation. I was on a little show, on a little network show called Shadow Chasers, which you've never heard of, and you will probably never be able to find it. And it died very quickly. It was on Thursday nights against The Cosby Show, and it didn't last long. But that was our first freelance script. We went the traditional route of, you write a whole bunch of spec scripts. We had a feature. We had some TV episodes. We had both comedies and dramas, by the way. We liked them both. So we had samples and so forth. And our first agent was sending us out to pitch to sitcoms and to dramas. Our first sale was about this close as on a sitcom called House Calls. We were this close to making a sale, didn't quite do it. And I always think, if we'd just had one more vote in the room, I wouldn't be here, because I'd be doing some comedy podcast, because I'd be a sitcom writer, and my life would have taken a completely different turn. But the first thing we sold was a drama episode that we pitched to these people on Shadow Chasers. That show died fairly quickly, but then the showrunners of that show went on to do the last 6th season of Fame over at MGM. They remembered us. They brought us on to do a freelance script for that show, or at least pitch a freelance script. Again, this is the way it used to work. You would research a show. You wouldn't write one. You wouldn't spec it, because they wouldn't read a spec, but you'd come up with a bunch of ideas. They would have read your other material and said, yeah, this person seems like they might be able to write our show, so come in and pitch us your ideas. And you'd pitch anywhere from 3 to 12 possible ideas for an episode of their show. And they would go, no, we don't like that one, or hey, we're doing something awfully like that, so no, or whatever. But hopefully you'd get to one they'd say, oh, we haven't done that one. That sounds actually cool. And you seem to know the characters. You seem to know the format. You seem to know the show pretty well. We're going to take a chance and hire you to do a freelance script for our show. And that was it. Sometimes that you would do that script, you would do 2 drafts and you'd be done and off you'd go. Very often, if they really liked you and they liked the work you did, they would say, you know, we'd like to bring you on staff. We'd like to, you know, have you get a salary and be in the office every day and helping us, you know, beyond one script. And again, we were very lucky that on Fame, after we did our first script, they said, yes, we definitely want you guys on as story editors. And we were on that show for 22 episodes. And then following the pretty more or less traditional pattern at the time, the show gets canceled, you're out of work, you maybe somebody from that show goes on to another show and they say, hey, you should look at these guys because they were really good on this other show. And you get a next staff job and you go from writing staff to writing staff, getting a little bit of a title bump and a little bit of a salary bump each time. So you'd work your way up from story editor to executive story editor to executive script consultant to finally the P word, producer, or co-producer, and then supervising producer. And everybody asks, what do these titles mean? And so the truth is they don't mean anything at all. They're completely arbitrary. Sometimes it's in lieu of a salary increase. But again, it's notches on your belt. It's more experience. You go from show to show. And eventually, after you've been on a number of shows and you've built up that experience, someone takes a chance on you and says, okay, come in and pitch us pilot ideas. Or, hey, we've got a pilot or we've got a something. And we think you guys are the right people to possibly run the show.
That's one heck of a journey.
And it used to be the kind of the standard way the business has evolved and so forth. And it's almost non-existent to follow that particular path. That's one of the things we're on strike about, because with the shorter seasons, and if you're doing 8 episodes or 6 episodes, you will have a much smaller writing staff. The showrunner may write all the episodes themselves, but you'll have a much smaller staff, and the staff may get together, break stories, write their 6 scripts or 8 scripts, and they're off the clock. They're gone. They've gone home, and it's only the showrunner that remains to actually stick around through production, do production rewrites as necessary, and follow the show all the way through production and post, which is a terrible loss for all the other writers, because they don't get to follow follow their episodes through the rest of the process. They don't get to do production rewrites. They don't therefore learn about what production involves or what post-production involves. They don't get to go cover set. They don't get to even casting or production meetings or all the stuff, which is where you learn. Basically, that's how you learn to be a showrunner, from essentially being an apprentice showrunner to whoever's doing the job and having them delegate and saying, okay, you're going to go to handle this and you're going to at least be in the room while we're doing the sound spot. What's a sound spot? All these things that you learn along the way, that's gone by the wayside these days. And that's one of the things that we're striking for, is to try and preserve or restore that system as much as possible. So that, because again, there are more scripted shows on the air now than ever. I think we broke 500 last year. Finally, 500 scripted television shows made in the United States. That's a preposterous number.
It's like, so there's this wide quantity, which is, I think, is interesting, but at the same time, it's like there's a quantity of story, but not mm-hmm. always a depth of story. Mm-hmm. Because when I think about the way that seasons used to be, when you're talking about 13 episodes on a short season and 22 to 24 episodes on an average season, there's space for a freelance script mm-hmm. to be put into rotation. There's space for some of the most classic, most awesome scripts that people don't realize were not done by like the immediate writing staff, but were scripts that were people who were watching the show and say, I had this idea. I know Offspring, I think, from Next Generation, I believe that episode started as a freelance episode.
That's the thing. When you have 22 episodes, again, it's almost a necessity that you reach out beyond the writing staff, unless you've got a gigantic writing staff. And if you've got a gigantic writing staff, that's a lot of writers working, which is a good thing too. Hopefully you'll have if you have a gigantic writing staff, chances are you're not hiring all of them upper levels, because you don't have that much money. So again, you're reaching out and you're including, trying to get a diverse crew of not just diversity in the people, but diversity in experience. So that, again, you want new faces, you want new perspectives, you want new voices in the room, and you want to, hopefully you have at least a little bit of interest in putting down the ladder to other people can make the journey that you've made too and grow into it. And again, to get that fresh idea, that's the whole reason we do the writing staffs. And one of the reasons we do the writing staff in the first place is I could maybe write 22 if you gave me 3 years and a lot of coffee, but they wouldn't be nearly as good as give me a writing staff and a bunch of talented people and a bunch of fresh ideas that we can bounce off each other. And it makes for a better product. And it makes for long-term, and this is part of the problem, is that the executives nowadays are not thinking long-term at all. They're just thinking short-term. How do we get the stock price up, and how do we strip mine and hedge fund this business to death?
How do they not get fired?
Exactly.
How do we make our profits go up 0.25%?
Mm-hmm. in the short term, while we're definitely poking holes in the boat for the long term. It's just, it's not good. I mean, it's not good creatively for us. It's not good. I don't think it's good long term for the health of the industry either. Mm-hmm. You know?
I would agree, but I think also something that's interesting, which, you know, when it comes to the strike and it comes to the Writers Guild and SAG and all of that, like the message I feel like has gotten out there that there are people who have a better comprehension of what's going on. But one thing I think is interesting, just when you mentioned people kind of training and kind of going mm-hmm. up within the industry, I feel like that is a ladder that you see in other unions. My granddad, he was the human rights commissioner for the Utility Workers Union, Local 12 in New York. Mm-hmm. And when he would talk about how he came up in the union, it's, I had someone, I was training, I was doing this, I became this. Like that entire process, even for someone who's working in electric or working mm-hmm. in the sewers or working on the train, like you have that gradual training and development of responsibility. I think that's one of the interesting things that you also see in the WGA, which again, I don't think people are really aware of those parallels, that training, that development, that I'm getting better and better, and that there's a need for development and maturity, which is, it's hard to comprehend. I have this weird story. I remember I was on the train once and talking to this one woman. And we were both like actress, performers, et cetera. And she was just talking about just how hard she was working. And I was like, girl, I get it. And we mentioned like Disney and the people who we knew who like worked on the Disney parks. I was like, yeah, they just need the water. And this is happening. And all this stuff is happening behind the scenes. And, da, 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 and they sweating and they don't get lunch. Mm-hmm. Da, da, all this other stuff. And this guy on the train was like, you're ruining the magic. And I looked at him and I was like, magic takes work.
Yeah.
And I feel like a lot of people miss that when they see the magic on the TV screens or on their iPhones or on their movies. It's like magic takes work. Magic is labor.
Magic takes skill.
Yeah. And to some extent also, because we don't want to ruin the magic, we don't really, there's aspects of this business that are, and aspects of the process that are sometimes less than wonderful. And sometimes I say, after I've had a particularly awful week, this television is like sausage. You really don't want to know how it's made. You really don't want to know what goes into it. Just consume it and enjoy it and don't pick it apart too much. So but as a result, I think there's a lot of people that have a distorted image of what it is that we actually do. That we're all sitting in our Beverly Hills mansions and writing scripts like Clifton Webb in the bathtub in Alora with the typewriter on the platform, and then actors just come to the set and just toss off these wonderful lines, and it's just this piece of cake, and we all just go, then we go home and we all bathe in money. And it's not that. It's a lot of long days, it's a lot of grind, and people work really hard and sometimes under really challenging conditions,
And I think there's also a misconception of writers that we are in some way responsible for the content that's out there now. I guess I've been on social media and trying to convince people why this is a labor movement. Mm. And a lot of the responses I got were television, like everything's a reboot. Everything's copying something. Like nothing's original. Writers aren't really working. And I was like, there's just such a difference between what writers do and the decision makers who decide what's on air. Just the amount of creativity and brilliance in this industry is like a galaxy. And what you actually see is like a moon.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one aspect of the business that I think that we're trying to communicate during the strike, is there is a creative side and then there's the money-making business side. And right now they seem to be fighting against each other.
Yeah. If you're angry about all the reboots and the lack of blah, 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 don't come to us. Go to them.
Thank you.
Ones that are making the decisions. And also, when something small and new and different does come out, support it. But instead, there's the Marvel stuff is getting a lot of attention because it gets a lot of attention. Hey,
and
a lot of people are watching and a lot of people are enjoying it. Hey, what you want more originality? Seek out originality. I hear this also in the comic books and in books, in novels as well. You need the franchise, blah, 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 blah. And all the big franchises are sucking up all the oxygen. Then help. Go patronize the ones that need more attention. It's hard to break through all that. It's hard to get the attention on something small like that.
I actually want to
the whole Barbenheimer phenomenon right now is just those are two really unlikely movies to be smash hits together in the summer of 2023. And you would hope that somebody would learn the lesson from this, but no, the lesson that we've learned is, oh, what other toys does Mattel have that we can make movies out of? It's horrible. What other war criminals can we give biographies to? How about the guy that invented mustard?
Yes. History Channel right now.
Huh? Oh, God.
Ooh, what can we bring to the big screen?
Mm-hmm.
That's funny. That it's funny and it's sad. And it's very interesting because this particular podcast, I don't talk a lot about Marvel movies, but I do a little bit. And I remember at the time when Farscape was originally out, there was like Blade and a couple of the X-Men's, but it wasn't like comic book movies really getting any respect, very little money. And everyone's like, okay, why are you doing this stupid thing? And having the Marvel universe develop, you know, and watching it as a process, there was no way to predict it would be what it is now in 2008 when Iron Man came out. No way. But what I think is interesting is that I feel like it went from this very niche thing where it's like occasionally we get a semi-okay movie, but pretty much they're all bad, to what it is now. But now it's oversaturated and it's no one found the balance. And it was just amazing. But speaking of originality, Brittany, you, I believe, have produced 13 short films. Is that correct?
Yeah. I'm glad you know the number. I was like, it must be 13. Maybe it's more now, but we'll go with that.
And so I feel like when you do short films, and especially if you take them out to festivals and all, that is things from beginning to end.
Yes.
So yeah. How do you feel? What were like the experience of those creative ventures like? And how do you feel it may have helped your TV career, if it did?
Oh, I'd say if I'm going to plug film school, the thing I really loved about Columbia was like their first year, they encourage all the writers. They make the writers, directors, and producers all take the same class and all do the same exercises. And so I had to direct exercises, and writers had to produce them and directors had to write. And it's like we constantly rotate it, because their theory was, and it's true, that the more you know about everybody's role on set, the better filmmaker and collaborator you will be to understand that process. When I moved more into producing, and I wasn't really writing as much then, but I was producing other people's work, I think the biggest and most immediate benefit that comes to mind that we were just talking about is you learn how to be on set. And obviously it's a lot smaller, but shorts are like they're a great place to learn the rules of production. And again, what everybody's roles are and what the process is like bringing what's on paper to life. And I think it's like going from the frying pan to Dante's Inferno in terms of all the moving pieces that you're tracking in real time while not losing sight of the story and the future goal, which is to have a film on a screen for an audience. And you constantly, like, you just have two different brains constantly tracking the present and the future. Doing that on a short, I think, before getting onto bigger productions can only help you. And I think it helps you to respect everybody's role and process. Filmmaking is the most collaborative art form, and television making. I'm going to say filmmaking as a catch-all for television, everything on camera. It's the most collaborative art form that there is. And it requires everybody to just bring their A game and 100%, even down to doing the titles for it and like the music score. And like everything is just how an audience experiences the world. So I think it was great experience. I would love to get more on shorts. LA doesn't have as big of a shorts making culture as I think New York does, but maybe there'll be something after this that makes America want to see more short films.
Definitely a possibility. I know working on my own short, it was just like, okay, we're just going to find a way to make this work. And I need y'all to trust me, and I'm not paying anyone, but I'm going to feed y'all. Love y'all.
Yeah, you do. You learn a lot about yourself and how you work with other people and if like how to be collaborative. Yeah, I guess that's an important part, is like you learn not just about how set works, but how you work. And I think I learned, like, one of my strengths was I could actually remain more calm than I thought, but a weakness was I was really bad at confrontation and anxiety over, or having anxiety over trying something new. And I just resolved that I was going to be the kind of filmmaker who said yes as much as I could. And if I couldn't say yes, if I had to say no, then I would try to get as close to yes as I could. And it's just required knowing that I was like, okay, I'm naturally risk averse, but the director or the writer, whoever really thinks they want to do this, like, how can I say yes to this and build something great? Which it seems like people did a lot of them.
I was just about to say, you would have fun down there. Yeah. It was also an environment there. We had some Americans that came down that couldn't really get into that mindset that they had the more traditional, this is your job and you shouldn't be doing this other thing, or this is not how it's done, blah, blah, blah. They were without necessarily meaning to be negative, but just, again, just couldn't get into the swing of things. We're very type A Americans. And part of it also was, again, a difference in the Australian temperament as well, because you'd go down there and say, we need this gel on the set at 8 o'clock tomorrow morning. And the Australians, no worries, mate, she'll be right. Which we quickly learn means it's not going to happen. There's no way on earth it's actually going to happen like that. It'll happen sooner or later. No worries. What the hell? So, you could easily go crazy down there if you were a type A American. But those of us that sort of relaxed into, the crew works a 12-hour day max, and they vote on whether they want to work overtime. And usually they vote it down. And you're able, but guys, we're about to go into double golden slasher time, but mate, I'd rather go to the pub. We'll finish tomorrow. So
that is a work-life balance I have never seen.
I'm telling you, but they have wonderful pubs. And it was like, and you know what? We got it done. We got it done. We had to make adjustments. We had to make we did like a 7+3 shooting schedule because of the shorter days. And we did, so it was like 7 days of A unit, and then we'd pick up 3 days of B unit, which was a complicated logistical nightmare, but we did it. We got it done. I think it looks pretty bloody good. We managed to go to a fair number of pubs. And
we probably liked each other more at the end of it all.
Yeah, I think we did. Yeah, we were just as tired, but we were happy.
We were happy. I feel like that's the feeling you want to get after every big artistic endeavor, whether it's film, whether it's television, whether it's theater. You know you're going to be exhausted. That's somehow that's part of the plan. If I'm not tired by the end of it, I don't feel like I've worked hard enough. But I also want to be pleased with what we've done. And actually, what you said reminded me, I think it was an interview with Rob Reiner talking about
working with the British crew.
And then we're like, okay, tea time. And he's like, what? It's in our union contract. So these guys need to break. And we have to, so they were just like these specific limits that the crew had that he was like, now I have to adjust to working with the way this particular crew works. Which I find interesting. And you mentioned, Brittany, just questions around what will happen toward the end of this strike. Will there be a desire for shorts or new projects coming out? Mm-hmm. And Ricky, I saw that you have been, of course, through several strikes with the WGA.
I'm very old.
But during the 2007-2008 strike, you made a short for Strike TV, which I thought was cool, called Fusion. So what was that experience like? And could Strike TV come back?
Good question. It was something that some writers put together. They say, hey, we're not doing anything. Why don't we? And everybody's saying, why don't you guys just do the United Artists route and seize the means of production and do stuff yourself? In the old days, the answer to that was, if we do, what could happen to it? Where's it going to go? But this was, there's this new thing called streaming, and maybe there is a way to get these things on without having to. We can bypass the gatekeepers, make our own stuff, and actually get it to an audience directly. How cool. Hey, let's take a shot at it. We're all sitting around. Let's make some stuff. Keep ourselves occupied, if nothing else, and maybe open up a new method of production. So I had an idea for just a little science fiction thing that could go more episodes and so forth, and wrote a script and basically called in every favor I had in the business and got a whole bunch of volunteers together. I managed to get Brian Trenchard-Smith, wonderful Australian director who's done a ton of wonderful genre stuff down there. I managed to get some real actors interested. Basically, we shot it over a weekend. Not true. Friday night, we got some establishing shots and some street running around shots. But Saturday, but basically 2 days. And I wrote it with that in mind. Okay, it's going to be basically two sets, basically two people. Again, I was bringing all my television production experience to bear on, okay, how much cool stuff can I get into this thing and still be able to shoot it in 2 days and for dead cheap? And we just, again, called in every favor I knew and promised, hey, we will all share in the profits if this thing ever sees any, which it, of course it didn't, but we basically just did it and had fun. Half of it shot in the Writers Guild garage, as a matter of fact. That was one of our locations. We managed to, it was fun shooting in our own basement, as it were. And yeah, it was a fun experience. And there were some other, I think there were about six or eight other shorts made for this Strike TV. And again, there was some interest from some places here and there about taking it forward, but no one actually came up with the money. And I said, I'm not going to ask anybody to work for free ever again after that weekend that everybody put in, because you're asking a lot of people. And again, everybody came in the labor of love and they worked very hard. And I also managed to get much more production into it than I thought I would, because, here somebody can be our UPM, and she brought along, I know, this person for crew and this person for crew. So we actually got like actual hair and makeup and prosthetic people. We actually got an actual post house and actual editors. I thought, I'm going to be just doing this at home on my laptop or whatever. And we actually composers and so forth. So we did manage to get a lot into it. But it's very tough. And again, it's the case of, great, now we have it. What do we do with it? You know, is it going to be, it's still going to take money to put this thing forward. And as Brittany knows, you know, there's no such thing as free for real, really. I wound up going a fair bit out of pocket on it. Just things like, and again, this production stuff that I didn't even realize, you know, where's your insurance? That's the one thing they said, you better not skip. My lawyers, you're going to have to get insurance. Any problem at all, if anybody gets injured, you're going to be bankrupted. So you better have liability insurance. Okay, that's one corner you can't cut. And then you find other things. No, we're not going to shoot this on somebody's camcorder. We need actual equipment. So we've got to rent some equipment. Some people have some stuff, but it became a big deal. You know,
it piles. I'm not even going to say it just adds up so quickly, because we're dealing with, for it to look good and for people to want to watch it, it takes a lot of money. I hope that audience members can understand it's not as simple as fundraising. For I've seen people spend at least maybe I've seen like some six-figure shorts.
Oh, easily, maybe, sure, yeah.
Which it goes very quickly, and if you want to do it well, so I could see. And yeah, once you ask for a weekend of people's time doing it for free, it's hard. You don't, like, as your friends, they can't exploit you though, because this is your craft that you've worked to develop. The same way as you can do, I will happily help my mother write something for free and help her friends, but then after a while, it becomes you want to be compensated for your efforts. Not that I charge my mother for anything, but sometimes I'll help her with her business work. She thinks I'm a better writer than her, but she's perfectly fine. But it's all, look it over. But yeah, people should be compensated for their work and compensated fairly.
And I think also it's like compensation when you can afford it. And then also the type of, I feel like there's something interesting about the type of set you try to put together when you are in charge of it, especially if you are unable to pay. At least for me, I'm like, when I was like grabbing my friends together, I'm like, I can't pay you guys, but I want to make sure that we do have breaks and we do have timing. And I am organizing this as much as possible to get you out of here as soon as possible. Because I'm like, want to make sure that whatever is happening is a place that you feel safe, you feel comfortable, and that we have the best environment together. And one thing I think has been challenging, especially if anyone's on the social medias, because they're like, why don't you just do it yourselves? Why should you just do it yourselves? And I did it myself with $12 and a stick of peanut butter. And just, but did you have insurance though? But did you actually pay people though? But did you do this though? Because that's what a full-blown professional production takes. And yes, you and your buddies can create a short in a weekend. That is completely possible. But that's not the level of like quality, and that's not the level of work that we're putting into the concept of where we're trying to go with what we do next. And so I think there can be a huge disconnect, which is an interesting part of our social media lives these days. But actually, One thing both of you have talked about is collaboration and just what a big deal that is. The idea of the isolated screenwriter in their room and they're like doing art by themselves where they think these massive ideas. So this idea of like TV writers like to work together is kind of like, We don't know what that is. How do you do that? But also, Brittany and I were at Shore Leave. Shore Leave, if you don't know, is a science fiction convention in Baltimore. And Ben Browder and Claudia Black were also there. And it was really great to hear them talk, but also talk about the collaborative and them actually not just being given scripts, but also being in the writer's room sometimes or throwing ideas out. And Ricky, I've read some of your interviews where you're like, and we're just doing this. And then they drop by. And then later on, we have a meeting. And then something that Ben said becomes a thing. And then, and it was really interesting because they seemed to have somewhat differing views on this. Because I think Ben was like, yeah, it was great. It was fun, but it wasn't the way it was supposed to be done. And then Claudia was like, but we were co-creators. And she kept on saying that we were like, co-create, co-collaborate. So it was interesting just seeing that. So what role do both of you think that a collaborative environment between writers, actors, makeup, CGI has on a piece of media versus one where everything is more like siloed and you're like, you do your job?
Well, I've been on both of those extremes of on shows. The most extreme, in a good sense, of the freewheeling collaboration, David Kemper, the showrunner, would take a good idea from any place. And he set the tone for an environment where anybody could come in with an idea and it would get entertained. And it was definitely not a case of you're overstepping your bounds by it was like, the more the merrier, let's do this. And he had the flexibility and made sure that as writers, we all have that same flexibility of let's just go with this. Let's try it. Let's see. We may fall on our faces. It may turn out terrible. We made some stinkers, but every show makes some stinkers. If you don't swing big, though, you'll never hit one over the fences. There's a great quote that he has that he says, I would tell people to scare me. Come in and pitch me an idea that scares me to my core. I want to resist it. I want to be so afraid of this idea. And then I want you, with your passion for this idea, to convince me to give it a shot. And then I want you to deliver, to then sit down and actually make it work, which it's a challenging environment, but it brings out the best in people, I think. And again, on all levels, where the actors can come in and suggest things or whatever. And again, and I've been on the other extreme of the show where I've been on shows where the writer wasn't even allowed to go down to the set. We're on the lot. I know. It was mind-boggling. But don't go down to the set. Don't talk to the actors. For God's sakes, don't do anything the actors ask you to do. Don't do anything but basically sit in your office, type pages, and slip them out under the door. You don't get to go to casting. You don't get to go to post. You don't get to go to read-throughs. If we're even doing read-throughs, everybody's locked into their job, and that's it. And sometimes on the show, I've understood why that's been the case, because in the example I'm thinking of, the show was so far behind on scripts and was shutting down because they didn't have stuff to shoot sometimes because it was such chaos that, yeah, no, we don't want the writers doing anything but writing because we need the material. But it does not make for good material. It may get the show shot and you may make the air dates, which is that in television, that's the first commandment, thou shalt make air dates. So I understood it, but it was not a pleasant place to work. It wasn't a pleasant environment. And I think the work suffered a lot because of it. For me, and my ideal environment is, yeah, somebody's in charge. You definitely want somebody to make the decisions, as I've been in a situation where there is somebody in charge, but their decisions are unclear. Their vision is unclear. They're changing their minds all the time. They don't know what they want until they see it. So you wind up on a show like that doing a whole lot of exploratory work, writing a lot of stuff that they can treat like a buffet and say, I'd like this, but I don't like this. And personally, I don't mind working really hard. I don't hate work, but I really hate wasted work. I really hate wasted work. So yeah. And so if you're on a show where the showrunner can't make up their mind and things are going back, or the network and studio can't make up their minds and they're going back and forth and they approve something in outline and then it comes to script and then they want to make changes that should have been made in outline, that's when I think it's up to the showrunner to plant their feet and say, no, guys, you liked it over here and now you don't like it. So we can either stop and start over and push production, or you can just say, we'll adjust it as much as we can. We'll just go ahead with it. You definitely want somebody with a firm hand on the tiller, as it were. But at the same time, you want to have that room to collaborate. You want that room to let everybody make the show better.
Stick up for the story.
And to stick up for the story, exactly.
What does that mean, to stick up for the story, Brittany?
Gosh, I hope this doesn't get me into trouble with any executives or bosses, but I think the people that
I'll do it for, if you like, because I don't care.
So I want, but you know what? I shouldn't be afraid, because this is the real problem. I think I said earlier that so many people are afraid of getting fired. And so they make decisions based on the executive level, on the studio and the network or distributor side, about what their boss wants. And eventually all those people are answering to a boardroom, and the boardroom is answering to shareholders. The days of answering to the audience and what could make a good story, I don't know when they left, but they left a long time ago. And so I've been on notes calls where sometimes I'm wondering where a note came from or who it came from, because I know it didn't come from this executive. I know they were gung-ho about this story before, but it came from someone else on high, or laterally because they have a similar show, or they realized they were in some meeting and they got pushback from even like shows that we were told. It was like when I was on a show, that it was like, they were like, it's very homosexual. That's what we got. And I was like, well, yes, we're doing a show about a homosexual inventor. But they're like, could you pull it back? And I was like, but who told you that? Because I know it was from some type of focus group or marketing person, or it was just somebody's decision somewhere. And I think that when the people that you know love the story for the story's sake, it's the actors and writers and directors and producers who were there, who are just coming, like, you understand that this whole thing is constantly a conversation and a dialogue. I don't even want to call a television episode or a film like a product, but maybe it's like a living kind of thing that you're all constantly collaborating with. I think it's really great, the idea that as a writer, like, you give up you hand in your pages, and then you know it's going to have a life beyond you. You have to be able to shepherd those pages from the page to the screen. And that's where being on set comes in hand, and being able to troubleshoot issues, being able to understand where the arc of the story is going for character continuity, what's important. That's a little bit about what we're fighting for writers to be able to be on set, because your writing doesn't stop when you leave the page, but it's like a writing in a different form, and you're seeing the writing happening in front of you on set, where people are adding and making the script into what you recorded on a camera. Yeah, that was just a long way of saying, I think it's collaborative.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we've lost the decision makers who realize that.
Trust me, we've never had them in great profusion. We may have had more of them, I think. I can easily do an hour without blinking on network and studio note horror stories and so forth. And some good ones, too. Yeah, everybody's got horrible note stories, because, yeah, these are not creative people. If they were creative people, they'd be doing creative things. They're not really creative people. And it takes a special kind of executive to realize that and to say, okay, I'm going to go with my gut. Part of the trick of being a showrunner, it's not so much, I have an artistic vision, blah, 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 and I am an artiste, but it's a case of, this is the thing. This mm-hmm. is the thing. This is the thing you bought because you liked this, and therefore that's what we're going to make. And therefore all of our efforts, executive-wise, studio-wise, production-wise, is going to be toward making that thing. And then that thing may change. We may decide, and it very often happens, okay, now that we've started making the thing, we like this aspect of the thing more than we like this aspect, so let's move the thing over this way a little bit. We'll make adjustments, as long as, again, but it's everybody on the same page. Where it becomes horrible is where the network or the studio or the powers that be can't see the thing, or they don't know what the thing is, or they suddenly want to change the thing every other week, and you go, wait a minute. I think when you talk about protecting the story, William Goldman he calls it the spine of the piece.
Yeah.
You do a thing and it's got a spine. It's not the plot. It's not the theme. It's not any of those kind of traditional dramatic terms. The spine of the thing is the thing that if you change this, it's now a different thing.
Yeah.
That you have to protect with your life. That's the thing you have to hold on to. And that's part of the trick of being a showrunner, is to be able to identify what it is, be able to communicate what that is, and protect what that is. And then that frees you up to this other stuff. Yeah, I would prefer X over Y, but that's not the spine. I can give way on that one. I can't, that's not a hill to die on.
No, you have to know what is the thing that, if it's a television show, what keeps people coming back? There's interesting things over here and interesting things over here, but what is that thing that is central that, and I feel like when I'm watching television, when I'm watching film, especially something I really love, there's an emotional connection to what I'm watching. And you can feel when that emotional connection gets broken or gets squeezed in a particular episode or something like that. And you know, what happened? This wasn't what I was falling in love with. Mm-hmm. And it can be very sad when that happens. I know, like for me as a viewer, especially as someone who, like you all, I somewhat went to film school. And as I learned more about it when doing research, I'm like, wait, I think the showrunner changed, or the writing staff changed, or this changed, or something about the vision changed, or you found out that the executive who really fought for it is no longer there for whatever magical reasons. And all of a sudden, whatever, someone saw a different heart than what you originally started. It's very interesting. And also, again, when it changes, but it changes in a way that it loses something, that's hard.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I do love the idea of actors contributing to the characters, because I was trained as an actor, and I like what you like a character's in you. Sometimes actors end up writing it better than the writer could because they're living it, but still you're there to understand the arc of the story, not just the character's arc. That sounds like that'd be the best environment, I think, to have actors come in and give thoughts, because they know what their character would and would not do. Because Lord knows, you go to the Reddit boards and there people are talking about, this was so out of character, this character hasn't grown, but people are talking about it, but it's too late after the fact and you can't go back and change it. But I would love to have that kind of input beforehand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it does it again, the stereotype of the bad actors, the one that's always, I need more lines for myself, I am the center of the show, I want to get, yeah. There are some like that, but again, my experience is that most of them are instead, I want to make this thing good. I want to be able to act this. If I'm having a problem with it, I'm not going to be able to deliver. I'm not a magician here. So help me understand what this scene is about. Help me understand, make adjustments. Or I've got cool ideas. I can see my character going in this direction or that direction. And yeah, as a showrunner, you say, yeah, I think this is something to pursue. Maybe not so much this, because again, we've got other plans here, whatever. And again, being willing to go for it too. That's part of it also. And again, talking about the short seasons and having all your scripts in the can before you go out and shoot your 8 episodes. I think another one of the things that's really harmful about that is, it's once you start to see what works on screen, it's too late to change anything. Yeah. Oh man, the beauty of 22 episodes. It took us half a season on Farscape to figure it out, really. I think about 2/3 of the way through season 1 is where we finally got, okay, this is where the show wants to live. This is where everybody seems to be working at maximum. Okay, it took us a while to find that. You know?
That's what I love of being a viewer, especially a viewer of sci-fi. I remember after Game of Thrones ended, and I think people were like on a fantasy fix and they decided to start watching The Witcher. But I feel Game of Thrones is really a political allegory, whereas The Witcher is a full-on fantasy show. And so people are watching it and not understanding what was going on. And I was like, that's the way fantasy shows work. You don't know what's going on until at least the 3rd episode. And then you don't really get the plot until the 6th. That's how these things operate. But unless you've grown up or you know how to watch a longer story, you miss, because you can tell, okay, I think they found their groove here. And it's really interesting when that happens in a show, because you can, again, you feel it.
So often now, if you don't nail it in the pilot, you're gone. That's really what pilot season is. But you think you haven't just started to gel until halfway through the season and figuring out what it was.
And this is, you pray for this sort of thing in television, where this thing is working so well that we are now going to, whatever the plan was, this is better. So we're going to make a new plan. We're going to change things. We're going to adjust to this. We're going to adapt to this.
That's what happens when you let the kind of creatives do their work.
Let the creatives do their work. Like that. There's something really interesting, I feel, when it comes to people who may not understand that that the creative part is the work, and like the parts that we can't explain, we're like, this is just magic. This, we're just going to run with it. Where it's, there's a desire to quantify creativity, I feel, and a desire to make it easily, not replace, yes, replace now when we talk about AI, but make it like easily cataloged, easily understood, and easily controlled. And I feel like when there are people who feel like, oh, we can't control what this art is, there's a fear of it. There's a jealousy around it. Just, it's very interesting. It's very odd. But we mentioned that you've had a lovely long career, Ricky. And if I'm timing this right, you've been through at least 3 different writer strikes.
Yes. I came in after, I got in at the end of 1985. So I missed the 85 strike. But I was in time for the 88 strike and for the 2007-2008 strike. So this is my 3rd strike, but I'm not out.
So what do you feel is similar or different of the strike you guys are on now to the ones in the past, and particularly the 2007-2008 strike?
I think in this strike, what's different is the executives are being even larger dickheads than they ever were in the previous strikes, that they seem particularly obstinate and not acting in their own self-interest remotely, which is very often the case with executives. But particularly in this case, it's like, what are you people doing? What's wrong with you? When you look at how little we're actually asking for versus how much money they're making, it's just on a straight robotic dollars and cents thing, it doesn't make any sense. It's one thing to deal with greedy sharks, but greedy sharks that seem to be eating their own tails seems to be at a kind of a new level. And on the other side of it, what I'm seeing is much more unity in the guild and between the guilds than ever before. Writers are a cantankerous bunch. Writers are, it's like herding cats. And in the previous strikes, there were factions that said, what are we striking for this? DVDs, there's never going to be any money in that. That's not something to go out for. Or that's something, why are we striking for that? That's not going to, I'm a television writer and that only benefits feature writers, so who cares? Or vice versa. Or I just don't want to lose my job. Can we please just settle this and get back to work? Because nothing that we're asking for sounds like it's going to benefit me enough to make it worth my losing my job here. There were always factions. There was always sections of the guild, look up the Union Blues, things like that, where people were not nearly as unified. So it was a matter of, how long will this guild hold together? You know, how long can we stay on strike without defections happening and all that stuff? But this time around, I see a huge amount of that. 97.9% strike vote was amazing. And again, I have not really heard a whole lot of voices within the guild saying they're doing it wrong. Everybody seems to be pretty much on the same page, as it were. And I think also,
I've heard people wanting to go further.
As long as we're doing this, let's get what we really need to get. And again, I think that's such a gigantic miscalculation on the part of the AMPTP, that I think if they come with a sort of a half-assed, okay, semi-decent deal, we'd be having a lot more difficulty right now. But the fact that they came with nothing, and that they went to this Screen Actors Guild with nothing, has basically lit fires under both guilds. That's the other thing that's different this time, is that both guilds are on strike at the same time. That has not happened since 1960. And thank you, my predecessors of 1960, because the 1960 strike got us health care, got us a pension plan, and got us residuals. 3 things that are very near and dear to my heart in my old age. So personally, this strike, what do I personally stand to gain in this strike? Probably nothing at all. There's nothing, oh my God, if this goes through, it's going to benefit me personally. But I don't care, because this isn't my strike. This is your strike. This is for Brittany. This is for everybody else coming up. Just as those people, those wonderful, brave people in 1960 that sacrificed things to get us the things that made it possible for me to be able to say right now, I'm not worried about being out of work right now. Thank you very much. I've got a health plan. I've got a pension coming in. I'm well taken care of, thanks to the people that walked before me. Mm-hmm. Now I need to pass that on. Now I need to help the next group hold on to what we've, much less advanced, but at least just hold on to what we've got, that they can have, for one, that they can have careers. I'm not sure that there are careers to be had at this moment in TV writing that vaguely even resemble anything like the career that I've had. That ain't fair. It's just not fair.
Thank you for defending us and the profession. It's like standing up for the profession of writing and its integrity.
Yeah. It's been very good to me. I want to keep it going. I want everybody to keep it going. And it's just, we need to pass the torch. And also, I want to have good stuff to watch in my old age.
Absolutely. Brenda, I wanted to pass that on to you. Just, you mentioned that you're pretty early in your TV writing career. So how do you think the strike is engaging, impacting newer writers as opposed to more experienced writers like we've just heard from Ricky?
I think it's strange coming into it at this point, because I was talking to a friend of mine about this on the picket line, where we were talking about, it's like being on the beach, being a TV writer is like being on the beach, like after a really rough hurricane. I mean, you're thinking you should be on the beach. You should be happy. I am a TV writer. This is what I wanted. Why am I not happy? And it's because you constantly, like, you're being pulled into the water, and there's, you know, just a really strong current working against you. And you're just constantly bashed over and over again by the waves that keep knocking. Most, I feel like, knocking me down. And I think anybody who's become a writer in the past maybe 7 years, like, we've all experienced, like, COVID one really changed the game. It impacted it. And the fact that it was like going to Zoom rooms and less amount of people in rooms, and that changed the industry from what we thought we were going to have. Then after that, you had the economic uncertainty of 2021, 22, where the studios executives decided the content was not exactly king. And you saw a lot of, like, hundreds of thousands of hours of work actually not being seen, because either, like, they just shelved the projects and like completely, or they canceled seasons outright. Stories weren't finished. And then, so that was like another uncertainty, which I think going into this, growing up, in my 20s, I didn't think that was what the industry was going to be like, that you could work on something for 2 years only to have it never see the light of day. It's heartbreaking. And then now we get to 2023 with this strike. And so it becomes like wave after wave of, when it feels difficult, when you already didn't have firm footing, it's difficult. And I know that there are young writers struggling, but then we also know that there's no midway here, because it really is an existential question about writing. I think you are seeing executives behaving in a way, and they are coming because they came to the Guild with nothing. They came to SAG with nothing, because I think that honestly, that reflects what they think of us and what we do. I think that they can duplicate it with AI. I think that they actually don't need writers and actors in the same way. I think that they think of what we do as like a car on a manufacturing belt, and it's an assembly line, and writers act, then directors do this, then producers do this, and then the special effects people, but they think it's an assembly line, and then they're always looking for ways to like cut costs and look for efficiency. Mm-hmm. And I think it's just fundamentally flawed in how you look at this business. And I was like, we are not an assembly line. And I'm always for cutting costs and finding efficiency, but it's not going to be because you cut people and you found a way to, I don't know, have AI write scripts or be able to scan as an actor's presence and be able to use it in any project that you want in perpetuity. And I think, yeah, we understand that. We want to be writers, and seems like what I'm getting from the AMP is that they don't even see the values of writers and having them exist. I really think that they think that they can get along without us eventually down the line.
And I feel like that's terrifying. That's absolutely terrifying. One of the funniest, but goes to what you're talking about, signs that I saw on the picket line or pictures of the picket line was like, ChatGPT doesn't have childhood trauma.
That's hilarious.
It's so true. But we've talked about art and magic and human connection. And one of the reasons we can relate to television, to movies, to creative shorts, is someone sharing some of their human experience with us in a creative way, and us being able to connect with it. And so it's, even if you fed, you know, all of the scripts that there ever were into the large language model that is AI, and it spit out something scrambled back out at you, that doesn't mean that it will make you feel. It doesn't mean that it will make that connection, or when you watch something and it surprises you. But it's like this combination of things, I feel like, is a very human experience.
And you can't take the human out of the human experience.
The fun of television, though, is that forces you to be clever. It's like bottle shows. It's something.
I love bottle shows. We trap two people who hate each other into a closet shows. And
like, now we've got to be clever. We can't rely on cool special effects. We can't rely on a cool battle scene or a cool fight scene or any of that stuff. We got two people in a room, and it's now the writer that's got to make this thing work. And that's sometimes that prompts you to do your best stuff.
And as a budget saver, and then sometimes it could end up becoming like the best episode of a season. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Totally.
What is your recommendation for people, for laymen, for viewers who want to support the strikes, who want to support what you're doing, and who may also want to support writers as a whole? And also, how can people follow both of your work? What are you doing next? And how can they support you individually? How can they support the strike? And how can they support you?
Brittany, start us off.
I'm trying to, how can people support the strike?
I'll start off if you want.
Actually, curious, because my parents are wondering, should I cancel my subscriptions? And I don't know if that's helpful, because that means people aren't watching what our friends have done. I know that they can donate to the Entertainment Fund and other resources which are helping to support people striking during this time who don't have a paycheck and who could really use. It seems like the sides are going to dig in this fall, and I think any donation of support could help.
Totally with you on that one. The guilds, both of the guilds, I believe, have actually stated that they are not suggesting any sort of boycotts or anything like that at this time. That if anything, it might be even counterproductive, because Netflix is saying, hey, look, our numbers are down. That's why we can't afford to pay you guys what you're asking, which is, of course, preposterous. But so nobody's asking anybody to start canceling or anything like that. Instead, support your favorite shows, support your favorite actors and so forth. Donations are lovely. Yes, there are many places to donate. Some funds have been set up specifically for writers, specifically for actors, but there's a whole lot of others that are set up to support anybody in the industry that's being hurt by this. And I particularly personally like those kinds of charities, because we're all in this together. And I think it's useful for everybody in the industry to see, yes, we're going to try and take care of everybody. You know, this isn't just some selfish action that's just going to benefit us. And I think that's the solidarity of the guilds and the support I have to mention also the support we've gotten from IATSE and the Teamsters not crossing our lines. I have to single that out. I don't think that's happened to such a degree in previous strikes. I think that's a new thing that the writers have been able to successfully shut down productions just with their own picket lines, even before the actors came and totally put a spanner in the works. Just to see that solidarity between you, and also to see the solidarity beyond you, is that the UTLA has come out to support us, just as writers went to support UTLA in their last action. The whole thing with the Teamsters a week or so ago, which helped, I'd like to think it helped them actually land a contract that they're very happy with. And that's marvelous. So I think the more solidarity that we can show just across the board to all workers, it isn't just these millionaire actors. Yeah, they wish, or these pampered writers. Yeah, we all wish for the very, very many of us that are struggling to make healthcare minimums year after year. But to carry that out to, we want everybody. We want all the workers in the industry and outside the industry to do better than they're doing. CEO pay has skyrocketed so high, and the ratio is now so outrageously large that needs to change. So support that in whatever way I think you can.
Support labor.
It's just exactly. Simple as that. And if you don't think actors and writers count as labor, hey, come down sometime. Oh, another way to support, if you're in New York or LA, come down to the picket line. Love to have you. I've seen some people on the Twitter sort of going, gee, I don't know. Do you think it's okay to come and picket? I'm not an actor. I'm not a writer. I don't really want to be. Do you guys? No, please come down. The more bodies, the better. Come on down. Have a chat with us.
And it doesn't have to be for very long. You can stay for 30 minutes, an hour,
exactly.
Whatever.
Exactly. Come on down. Take a little stroll. We'll hand you a sign. It'll be cool. It'll be nice.
Come on down. Take a stroll. Join the picket line. Donate. I'm hearing a lot of options here.
Mm-hmm.
You can donate to places. You can donate to places that support the crew. You can donate to places that support actors, writers. Mm-hmm. You can join the picket line.
Mm-hmm. If you're driving by, honk on the horn. Let's make some noise. I think the more, just those are the ways that the positive ways to show support. That this picketing is a lonely business, guys. It drags on and it drags on. And we're all nervous. I've seen some sentiment to the, well, I see people on the picket line and they're laughing and they're doing karaoke and they're doing this. And then you guys are having a lot of fun being out of work, aren't you? Yeah, we're trying to keep our spirits up to keep the fight going because we're not working. We are not working. We are not earning salaries right now. And if anything we can do on the picket lines to keep our spirits up so we can hold our heads high and keep that camaraderie going. And on days when one of us is a little more depressed or a little more anxious about the future, that other people are there to cheer them up and to keep them going, that's a good thing. You know, I think that's part of the reason we pick it in the first place, as opposed to all sitting home out of work, staring at the wall and feeling very alone and feeling very powerless. In union, there is strength. In union, there is strength. And the picket lines are a way to show that strength, not only to the studios and the networks that we're picketing, but also to one another and to people looking in from the outside. But yeah, come on down, please.
There have been some great themed pickets, some great ones. And Ricky, after having this conversation, don't you think that there should be a Farscape picket?
There should be a Farscape picket. Absolutely, there should be a Farscape picket. Yeah.
Like sometime this fall, studio or network, whatever of your choice, actors and writers, and then people can come dress up.
Mm-hmm. I'm totally down with it. I was down with this idea when you brought it up at Shirleaf, so I think it's fantastic.
Oh yeah, Ben Browder was like, yes, let's do it. And he told me, he was like, get in touch with Ricky Manning.
He put it on me?
He put it on
you. Yes, yes. Oh, then, Ben had an entire conversation. It was fantastic to watch.
I wish I could have been there for that one. Yeah. I was picketing with Imogen, his daughter.
Cool.
That's what he said. Yeah, I had a daughter who was a television writer.
Very talented actress and writer. And again, yeah, she's been on a couple of shows. And yeah, it's a new writer who's just ready to start moving up, ready to do good things. And I fear for the business and I fear for her because I know what she's capable of. Again, I want to help make this a world where all these new people can shine and get their shot at it.
Thank you.
Yeah, so it's been lovely just listening to both of you and just hearing what you have to say about life and the industry and the craft of writing and the strikes. I've just really appreciated your time. So if people listening want to hear more from either one of you or see what you're doing, how can they find you across the interwebs?
I am still on, I'm not going to call it X to save my life. It's still Twitter. It will always be Twitter. I'm on Twitter as Frunium, Frunium. Frunium. I have a blog, which I've last updated in, I think, 1983, but it's still there. It's at frunium.com. There's some little stories and things from my career in there at frunium.com. And someday I may post again. It's more of a legacy site than anything else. I'm on Instagram as Frunium Ricky, I think. There's a Frunium in there someplace. And I'm also on Spoutable. And that's it. That's plenty. That's too much.
Are you still teaching?
Not lately, I haven't been teaching. I may do a class for UCLA Extension in winter quarter, starting in January through March, but I'm still waiting to hear on that one. I will also probably be back in Germany next summer at the International Film School Cologne, teaching a pilot class to 5 international students, which I've done twice already, and which is all sorts of fun. But I think it's a little too late to sign up for that one. And it's a bit of a commute. But yeah.
From America to Germany.
Yeah. Yeah, one of the rare things I actually do on my blog is I have a thing that says where I'm going to be writing or teaching next. Anybody that wants to see if I'm going to be teaching at Extension can check that out. Because once I know, I will post it and I will probably holler about it on the Twitter.
Sounds great. Where can they find you, Brittany?
Unfortunately, I would not be in Germany. That is where my favorite show is filmed, set Babylon Berlin. So I'm very jealous that you were there. But I actually had to go on Twitter and look up my handle because I never know. I never post, but you're welcome to reach out to me there. I try to be a social media lurker these days and not so much of a person who posts, just trying to be more of a fan and be kind of present in my personal life when I can be. But otherwise, you can find me at B Northcross. So it's at B E, like a bee that buzzes, and then my last name, Northcross. And it's pretty sure this is the same thing on Instagram.
Sounds good. Like I said, both of you, thank you so much for joining me. This has been a fun, a wild conversation. We have learned so much today. And yeah, I look forward to what both of you do next, and definitely wish you the best of luck with the strike. I hope that everyone gets exactly what they need. And y'all know where to find me. Hopefully I'll know where to find you. And hopefully the listeners also keep track of what's going on, because I feel like what is going on with these guilds, with these unions, it will resonate across labor. I know so many people are paying attention literally across the world. So support your local union, support labor, and also support creativity. If anyone listening wants to be a writer, or wants to be in the creative field, or has someone they love who wants to be in the creative field, like, it's possible and it's hard. So patience and hard work.
Thank you for having us. See you guys on the picket line.